Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, in which each time around from my North Wales spare room, I try to bring you a tale or tales of true crime that are often unfamiliar, perhaps long forgotten tales that the corners of the UK and Ireland have to offer. I am as ever Paul, creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title. I am accompanied by the true crime enthusiast cat, Pixie, who is never far from me, not really. And we are, in turn, joined by yourselves, the wonderful enthusiasts that make the show happen, for otherwise it's just me in the spare room talking to Peaks, and I do that often enough as it is, just not always about murder. Amazing as always having you join us today, folks, which I thank you kindly for, and I hope that as you have, then you join us with you and yours, all good, all safe, and all well. So straight down to it this time around then, and our tale this time around is a local tale for me, this one, local-ish anyway. It's a tale that took place some 17 years ago now, in Flintshire's largest town, Connah's Quay. Many a night spent down the boathouse and the custom house down there when I was a youngster, sometimes even venturing up into the Melrose, which is like the pub from Shameless, before ending up in wonderful old Styles, which I'm sure if you're familiar with the area, is a place that you'll remember. It's a truly horrendous and sad tale, this one, it really is, in which you'll hear of actions so despicable, I think they'll break your heart like they did mine, yet may invoke a certain degree of sympathy also. I'm sure you'll see what I mean as the tale progresses. The episode contains details and descriptions of a crime and events involving a child that some listeners may find disturbing and or distressing, so please use discretion whilst listening in all. Bearing that in mind, please join the True Crime Enthusiast for an episode I've entitled A Misplaced Sense of Shame. It was about 3:35 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday the 27th of November 2007 when the attention of on-duty staff at the Accident and Emergency Department of the Countess of Chester Hospital in Chester, which received notoriety last year of course as being the killing ground of Lucy Letby, the most prolific serial killer of children in British criminal history. The attention was taken with a young, confused woman who had burst in carrying a bundle and who had said, quite calmly, to a receptionist, "Will somebody help me? I think she's dead." The bundle that the woman, 31-year-old Joanne Hill, was carrying was the unresponsive, fully clothed body of her 4-year-old daughter, Naomi. And department nurse Jennifer Moore immediately checked the child for signs of life, noting that the little girl's skin was already by that time dark blue and mottled, and her limbs very stiff. Naomi was immediately rushed into resuscitation, and Jennifer Moore recalled later of Joanne Hill. "I was quite surprised, really. I would expect her to have been hysterical and distressed, but she wasn't. She was calm, really. She never followed Naomi into resuscitation. So I went back to reception, where she was sitting on the floor. We picked her up and took her to the relative's room and asked her what happened. She said, 'Nothing. I don't know. You are going to save her, aren't you?' In a giggle. You know, when somebody has had a few drinks and they're giggly like that." Now indeed, by then Jennifer had taken stock of the woman who had brought Naomi in, noting aside from her surprising demeanour over her unresponsive child, that her hair was all over the shop, her clothing was wet, untidy and unkempt was how Jennifer later described her, and she had the overpowering smell of stale alcohol about her, having clearly been drinking. Another nurse, Helen Stroyd, was called to the emergency and then spoke to Hill in the department family room, recalling later how Hill had asked, "Is she going to die? Can you wave a magic wand to make Naomi better?" Helen recalled, She appeared vacant, as if she was not listening to what I was asking. Meanwhile, consultant paediatrician Dr. Noel Murphy was in resuscitation battling to save Naomi, but was unable to find a single vital sign from her, noticing that rigor mortis had by then set in her upper limbs, and sadly, 20 minutes after their arrival at the Countess, Naomi was pronounced dead. When Dr. Murphy broke the tragic news to Joanne, just after 3:55 a.m, Helen Stroyd recalled. She became upset and had a look of disbelief in her face. She put her hands on her face and was crying, tearful. I asked her if she wanted us to phone someone for her. She told us there was nobody for us to phone. Now, due to the circumstances surrounding Naomi being brought in, her then unexplained death and the presence of rigor mortis already having set in, suggesting that the little girl had died some hours before she'd been brought in, her death was by then being treated as a suspicious one, and so police were contacted and attended the hospital. Police Constable Andrea Ellis was the responding officer, and later described Hill as being drunk upon her arrival, her eyes glazed over and her slurring her words. PC Ellis then asked Hill if she'd brought Naomi straight to the hospital from home and how she had got there. Now, Hill had initially told hospital staff that she'd arrived at the Countess in a taxi, but now admitted to PC Ellis that she'd arrived in her own car and had been drinking. That was the extent Hill could recall, with PC Ellis saying later, she said she'd come to hospital from somewhere in Chester, but she couldn't recall where. At 4:43 a.m, Joanne Hill was cautioned and arrested on suspicion of the murder of her daughter Naomi. PC Ellis later telling the court that when she was arrested, Hill had said, you're arresting me. My daughter is dead and you're arresting me. I want to see her to give her a hug and kiss. PC Ellis added, I explained that she couldn't see Naomi, so she looked at me and said, can I have a cigarette? PC Ellis furthered to the court that when Hill was taken to see Naomi, she started to cry and after seeing numbers on Naomi's hospital gown, had started talking about how Naomi had been learning numbers at school. She had then said, Grandma will be in heaven with open arms. PC Ellis added, after we left the room where Naomi was, Hill stopped crying straight away. She calmed down and once again asked for a cigarette. Taken to Runcorn Police Station following her arrest, more than one officer on duty there was later to recall on how calm and cooperative Hill was. Detective Sergeant Christopher Williams described her state as jovial, saying, she kept saying, I am really polite, me, to the custody sergeant. She was heavy in drink, and that had implications on the way she was acting. Indeed, Custody Sergeant Charles Taylor agreed that Hill was withdrawn, quiet, and very polite upon her arrival just after 6 a.m, and that she could answer questions, but he added into the detention register that she appeared confused and bewildered, and said her mind appeared to be somewhere else, noting that she'd even doodled on a pad on the desk. Sergeant Taylor had asked Hill a number of questions about herself, which she was able to answer, and solicited from her that she was currently taking antidepressants and had suffered from depression for a number of years. She also told him, when asked, that she'd overdosed and self-harmed in the past, but didn't go into any further details than this, and that she had consumed alcohol that evening. In view of this admission, he recommended that frequent checks be made on Hill while she was in the cells sobering up enough to be interviewed. A breath test she gave at 8:45 a.m. that morning found her to have 147 micrograms of alcohol in 100 millilitres of blood, against the legal drink drive limit being 80 milligrams. and arranged for a medical professional to assess her to ensure that she was fit for interview and detention. Mental health nurse Paul Gardner was able to assess Hill at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, November the 28th, and declared her indeed fit to be detained and interviewed, concluding, "She was not distressed, not preoccupied, she was expressing no signs of psychosis. There was no evidence of mental illness at all." Now indeed, Joanne Hill had shortly afterwards spoken to officers and confirmed what the results of the post-mortem performed on Naomi at Liverpool's Alderhay Hospital had the previous day concluded, that Naomi had died by drowning. Water in her lungs and facial hemorrhages around her mouth and nose pointing to the child's head being forcibly held underwater, a hand clamped over these. That Monday evening, Joanne Hill admitted to police that she had drowned her 4-year-old daughter in the bath at their home in Goya Close in Connors Quay that she'd shared with her husband Simon, Naomi's father. Simon Hill's world had come crashing down around him at 7 a.m. the previous morning, where, after a sleepless night going out of his mind searching around for his missing wife and child, he had been given the most unimaginable news by police who had knocked at his door that his daughter was dead and his wife had been arrested on suspicion of her murder. How must something like that be to hear? Later that same day, a spokesperson for Cheshire Police said, "There is an ongoing police investigation into the death of a 4-year-old girl from the Connors Quay area of North Wales. As part of that, 31-year-old Joanne Hill, also of Connors Quay, has been charged with murder." The following day, Thursday the 29th of November, Hill appeared before Chester magistrates charged with the murder of Naomi, where she was remanded in custody, no application for bail being made, and taken to Her Majesty's Prison Stile in Cheshire. At a subsequent court appearance on December the 10th, she was remanded further and committed for trial, scheduled for June of the following year. Meanwhile, neighbours of the Hill family in Goya Close spoke of their horror at little Naomi's death. One, who asked not to be named, said that the Hill family had been living in Goya Close for about 18 months, adding, "I just keep thinking, poor little girl. They seemed like nice people. The dad always said hello. We're just all shocked and horrified." Another neighbour, who had seen the 4-year-old that Monday morning when her father was walking her to school, said, "Naomi was a delightful girl, and we just can't believe she's gone. It is totally devastating." Staff and pupils at Golfton Primary School in Connors Quay, where Naomi was in the reception class, meanwhile, were said to be dazed by news of her death. Headmaster Paul Schleising had, on the Tuesday, sent a letter addressed to parents informing them a pupil at the school had died, which read, "It is with great sadness that I have to inform you of the sad loss of one of our children, Naomi Hill, of Mrs. Floyd's class, who passed away earlier today. The children were given the sad news by their teachers earlier on. Everyone in the school is absolutely devastated. She was a lovely little girl who had the special gift of lighting up our day and of bringing the best out in people. Our sincere condolences go to Naomi's family at this dreadful time." Now, the devastation at Naomi's death was felt everywhere, but equally, so was an inability to comprehend what had happened, it seeming completely alien, for many friends described Joanne Hill as a dedicated mother who doted on her daughter. One said, "She was absolutely committed to that little girl and was a lovely person. We had no problems with her at all, and always found her bright, helpful and friendly." So, what happens to cause such horror? To begin to explain, to give some background to that night of November the 26th, 2007, I will in part use the recollections of Simon Hill himself, taken from evidence that he was later to give to a court. He had first met Joanne in the mid-1990s through his sister Melanie, as they were friends, and they'd started a romantic relationship some years later in 1999, Simon recalled. Joanne was the life and soul of the party, very bubbly and confident. Some of my friends found her a bit loud, but I thought she was good fun. She was very attractive, and I really enjoyed her company. When their relationship started, there was nothing to suggest Joanne, who had left school with 8 GCSEs and had worked for Tesco in advertising sales before taking a similar job at Community Initiatives in Chester, had any problems. Although unknown to Simon then, she had first been diagnosed with depression at the age of 17, which she'd seen a child psychiatrist for, and for which, over the years, had periodically been taking medication. He first witnessed Joanne's depression at hand in April 2000, after both her grandmothers died in quick succession, one who she was particularly close to, and this, combined with the strain of organising a 30th birthday party for Simon that month, resulted in a collapse and Joanne being diagnosed with anxiety and depression. Simon recalled, "It hit her hard and I knew she was depressed, but I didn't realise how serious it was until the night of my 30th birthday party. Joanne had organised for our friends to join us in a restaurant, but once we were there, she got very drunk and became tearful. It was disturbing. That was when I first noticed she was ill. That's when I first noticed her depression. She was very withdrawn. I'd come home from work and she hadn't gone to work. She was just sat on the sofa. I'd never seen anyone at that level of depression before. She was a totally different person to her usual upbeat self. She became so ill that she was hospitalised for a week and moved out of the house we were then sharing in Chester to return to her parents' house in North Wales. But a few months later, on medication, Joanne seemed, in Simon's words, to be her old self, and he moved back into the house Joanne had bought in Phillip Street in the Hoole area of Chester. In 2002, they clubbed together and bought a larger £90,000 terraced house in Well Lane in Newton, a residential suburb of the city, got engaged and began to plan their future together. A wedding date was set for the 5th of July of the following year, but just a few months beforehand, the couple received some surprising news. Simon explained, "We'd never been sure if Joanne could have children, because she'd never had periods. She had a medical condition that meant she could have been infertile, so we weren't careful. We didn't find out she was expecting Naomi until she was 20 weeks pregnant. We were stunned, but delighted. We saw the pregnancy as an amazing gift." 8 weeks later, on June the 15th, Joanne went into labour. The baby was in the breech position, so she had to be born by caesarean, and because she was so premature, she weighed only 3 pounds 14 ounces. Her legs were no thicker than my thumb. But we both thought she was utterly beautiful, totally perfect. Now, doctors had taken Joanne off antidepressants during her pregnancy, and suddenly, as a new mum with a premature baby, she was overwhelmed and almost immediately suffered puerperal depression, a severe form of postnatal depression, and took an overdose. Simon recalled, "It seemed to hit her in a huge wave and she was taken to hospital after overdosing on her tablets. I don't think it was a suicide attempt. She wanted to take them to feel better, but took too many. She bounced back quickly when her medication was sorted out again, and nobody said she should be monitored in case her depression made her a danger to Naomi. The idea was never mentioned. Once she was released, with nurses visiting her twice a day and having resumed taking her regular antidepressant drugs, Joanne's condition seemed to stabilise, and on July the 3rd, the couple married in the local register office just 3 weeks after Naomi was born. But whatever bond had formed between mother and child during those difficult early weeks was to be stretched taut when, in less than 3 months after giving birth, Joanne returned to work for 20 hours a week to help meet the large mortgage payments, leaving Naomi with a childminder, Alison Hockridge. I approved of the arrangement because the childminder was fantastic. I also thought that Naomi would benefit from being around other children, and plus, we needed the money, said Simon. Being a working mum then, it was around this time that Joanne began getting that extra bottle of wine during a weekly shop, a reward for her for when Naomi was asleep. By July 2005, when Naomi had just turned 2, Joanne took her to the local doctors in Hool as she was having difficulty walking, her parents noticing that when she did, she appeared to limp. It was to be 6 months after this, in January 2006, that what the couple had referred to as Naomi's foot problem was diagnosed by Dr. Detlev Rogum, the specialist paediatrician at the Countess of Chester Hospital that Naomi had been referred to, as a mild case of cerebral palsy, a condition caused by damage to the brain before, during or after birth, which can result in difficulties in movement in the arms, legs and body, and which according to the charity Scope, between 1,500 and 1,800 children are diagnosed with each year in the UK. The diagnosis hit Joanne particularly hard and was a condition she was reluctant to accept, as Simon recalled. Joanne's reaction was not very good at all. Jo was on her own and went to the hospital to find this out from the doctor. When Joanne rang me after the diagnosis, she downplayed what she'd been told. She was saying the doctors thought it was nothing to worry about and we could get around it. Just a little tightness in Naomi's calves. It was a good half an hour we were on the phone before she told me it was cerebral palsy. She was obviously terrified of the term. However, the couple learned that the condition was mild enough that Naomi would be able to walk with physiotherapy, the help of calipers and special insoles in her shoes to stop her condition worsening, and apart from slight deafness, mentally, she was unaffected, which was a great relief for Simon. He explained, "When I heard that with a little help and medication, Naomi would lead a normal life, I was relieved. But Joanne took it badly, blaming herself. She didn't want to tell anyone about it, which I thought was strange. But her behaviour towards Naomi still seemed normal. She would delight in dressing her up in gorgeous little pink outfits. And we'd take her cycling and horse riding to help her legs." Simon recalled that as she grew, Naomi had a remarkable memory and could recite every word of her favourite Mr. Men books, saying, "We thought this was amazing. She also loved the Disney princesses. She wanted to be Cinderella or Ariel the mermaid. Joanne doted on her every bit as much as me." But Joanne struggled to accept even such a mild disability and constantly blamed herself for it, with Simon explaining. When she was poorly, she felt it was her fault Naomi had this disability. She had dark thoughts, did Joanne, and thought she was being punished in some way. At other times, she would say, "It's okay, she'll be fine with a bit of physio." She was trying to hide it away. Now indeed, Joanne did have a reluctance to tell anybody about Naomi's condition. She dressed her constantly in trousers to hide the calipers. She wouldn't allow her to play out in the street and displayed irritation by some of the effects of Naomi's medication. Because Naomi suffered constipation as a result of taking it, on occasion, she unavoidably soiled herself, which Joanne's patients with wore very thin and which she would scold the child for. Her drinking began to really take hold around this time, and she began rash spending on her credit card, buying clothes and alcohol, and on occasion neglecting to pay the mortgage, meaning that by May 2006, the couple were forced to downsize and sell their house, moving 8 miles away to the town of Coniskey in North Wales, and where Naomi was now placed with a new childminder, Karen Gallimore, who ran the Little Monsters nursery on Deeside's Kelsterton Road. Simon recalled that Joanne was initially enthusiastic about the move, but once they'd moved into their semi-detached home in Goya Close, overlooking one of Britain's biggest power stations, her depression quickly took hold again, combined with her drinking, which had never faltered. Simon recalled. She seemed unsettled and started changing her job every couple of months. Then, when I came home from work, I'd noticed that she was often drunk and wine bottles would be lying around. It started slowly, but snowballed out of control. I'd come in and find her slumped with a bottle in her hand while Naomi was sleeping on the sofa. She started spending a fortune on drink on our credit cards, and when I took them away, she took money from my wallet to buy alcohol. Once, I found one of Naomi's beakers filled with wine in her car, which horrified me. Every time I confronted Joanne, she would just say she knew it couldn't carry on and that she would stop. But she didn't stop, and aside from drinking in the house, she now often stayed out all night with her colleagues from work. This was interspersed with periods where the depressive illness caught up with her, for Joanne would regularly stop taking her antidepressants because she thought she was better, and so could do very little, described by Simon as, "She couldn't speak, let alone do anything else at the time. She kind of switches off, as if a shield comes up. She doesn't really do anything, just sits and stares." During such periods, Joanne didn't even acknowledge Naomi's presence, which unsurprisingly upset and confused the child. She had a further serious relapse on Boxing Day 2006, causing Naomi to need to stay with Simon's mother as he was suffering from pneumonia, and Hill leaving the family home to be cared for by her parents for a short time. But again, she made a quick apparent recovery, returning to work part-time in the March and full-time a month later. Later that month, Simon took Joanne to see her GP because she was again catatonic and staring into space, and she was referred from here to a crisis mental health team who visited her at home, two occasions giving Simon a chance to voice his worries about her drinking. But both times, he said, he was disappointed by the outcome, explaining, "I was told to just make sure she took her tablets and that she'd be okay. She could be a good actress, Joanne, and she'd persuade them that the drinking wasn't a problem. The crisis team said there was no need for her to be in their care." Yes, by June 2007, doctors had decided there was no need for further involvement by her local mental health team, and so in August, her case was closed, although she remained under the care of her GP and on several types of medication. Though Joanne appeared to recover, her drinking continued unabated, and on Thursday, November the 22nd, 4 days before Naomi's death, she again didn't come home after a night out. When the next day Simon drove to her workplace to ensure that she took her medication and discovered she'd spent the previous night with a male colleague, it was the last straw for the long-suffering husband. He explained, "I told her I couldn't take it anymore. I told her I didn't want her at home, and I no longer felt any love for her because of everything we'd been through. That day, Joanne told me she wanted Naomi to be fostered to Karen, and had even been thinking about having Naomi adopted because she couldn't cope. I asked why, and she said, she's always drinking, and I'm always at football, and thought she'd be better off with somebody else. I played football once a week and didn't train in the week. I was mortified she could even suggest it. It definitely wasn't an option, and said it was totally out of the question. She had suggested it a few times previously, But that was the time she was most serious about it. I tried to calm her down, telling her I'd look after Naomi and that we could work it all out. I never thought she would physically harm her, though. Joanne had then headed to the sanctuary of her parents' house, 10 miles from their home, and the following day, the Saturday, Simon drove up there to drop off some of her belongings, he recalled. Her car was parked outside, and it was full of hundreds of small, taster-sized wine bottles. I knew then that I'd made the right decision. Yet, by the following day, and perhaps wrongly thinking that the happiest home for a child is one with two parents, ideally, yes, but not always best that, and this home sounds pretty unhappy really, doesn't it? Simon's thoughts had turned to reconciliation, and he asked Joanne to come home, which she did. The next morning, the Monday, Joanne got up early, dressed smartly for work at Community Initiatives, a publishing company in Chester, selling advertising space where she worked on telesales, and headed into the office, telling her husband before she left that she knew she'd been a mess, but wanted to make things better. They both agreed that Joanne would collect Naomi from her childminder as normal, and after taking Naomi to school, Simon headed off to his job as a fleet manager for a car rental company. I thought Joanne seemed calm and rational and didn't see a problem with it, he said. That was the last time he was to see his wife for several months, for by 7 a.m. the following morning, police were knocking on his door to tell him that Naomi was dead. From what can be pieced together from Hill's later police interviews, tapes of which were played to the jury at her trial, at work earlier that day, the 26th of November 2007, Joanne Hill had resolved to kill both Naomi and herself. After she finished work, Simon called Hill at 5:09 p.m. and said he would be home by 7:30. So she stopped and had a quick glass of wine in Chester's railway pub before collecting Naomi from the childminder at 5:45 p.m. Driving her daughter home, Hill had stopped at the local Spa supermarket on Golfton Lane to buy more wine, where she'd laughed and joked with the shop assistant. At about 6 p.m, they arrived home, and Hill immediately headed upstairs and ran a bath while Naomi watched television, adding pink bubble bath as it filled almost to the top, and then came down for a glass of wine, her fourth of the day. Simon called once again at 6:08 p.m, and later described his wife as being quite buoyant while she was on the phone to him. Although Naomi had said she didn't want a bath, there was no struggle, Hill told police, as she then picked up her daughter and carried her upstairs. She undressed her and stood Naomi up in the tub, then forced her to sit down and thrust her face under the water, holding her daughter's head submerged for somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes. Researching and writing this episode, I didn't even want to try and imagine how terrified that poor little girl must have been in her last moments, though of course it was unavoidable. Monstrous actions. After drowning Naomi, without drying her body, Hill dressed Naomi in blue denim dungarees and a pink and yellow top, pink trainers and a purple duffel coat, before putting her on the back seat of her blue Renault Megane in her child seat, along with her handbag and the bottle of wine she had bought earlier from the Spa, and left the house at around 7 p.m. She later told police she wanted to be out of the house before her husband returned home from work at 7:30 and found out what she'd done. A later painstaking trawl of CCTV revealed that for the next 8 hours, Hill drove around aimlessly between the Deeside and Chester areas, stopping to drink the wine, to even buy another bottle, and to get petrol, as her dead daughter remained in the back seat. Meanwhile, through this period, a frantic Simon Hill, finding the house in darkness when he returned home, was ringing around all of Joanne's family and friends to see if they knew where she and Naomi were. He was constantly calling Joanne's mobile, to which there was no answer, and texting her, asking, "Is Naomi safe?" Hill never replied. That night must have been one of, if not the, longest and most terrifying night of Simon Hill's life, culminating in that knock on the door from police at 7 o'clock the following morning, ending his life as he knew it. Simon recalled, "My first thought was that Joanne must have been drunk and had a car accident. Then I was told she'd been arrested on suspicion of murder. I had to identify Naomi's body, which is the hardest thing I've ever had to do." The trial of Joanne Hill for the murder of her daughter Naomi began before the Recorder of Chester, Judge Elgin Edwards, at Chester Crown Court on Tuesday, September the 9th, 2008. Somewhat later than the June date it had been planned for, and one which had to be restarted that day following a jury being sworn in the previous day, having to be discharged for legal reasons. Though she admitted drowning Naomi, Hill, who the court was told would not give evidence in her own defence, denied murder, her defence arguing she was guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. On paper, a cogent argument, supported by the fact that that January, Hill's mental state had worsened to the point where she had been transferred from Stile Women's Prison to the Teith Llewellyn Medium Secure Hospital Unit near Bangor in North Wales, from where, each day of the hearing, she was brought to Chester Crown Court from, as opposed to from a cell in the local prison. However, the prosecution would not accept Hill's diminished responsibility defence, claiming they would show she was not suffering from any mental problems at the time of Naomi's murder and had not been entirely honest since she was arrested. In his opening speech for the Crown, Michael Chambers KC told the jury, "The prosecution say the defendant could not come to terms with the fact that Naomi was disabled, suffering from a mild form of cerebral palsy, affecting her ability to walk. She left a lot of the everyday care of Naomi to her husband Simon, and even suggested to him that Naomi should be adopted, but he would not agree to that because he doted on her. Instead of seeking help from social services or anyone, she quite consciously and deliberately decided to kill Naomi. We say she wasn't suffering from depressive mental illness at that time. She moved quickly and efficiently to do what she decided to do. Extreme behaviour such as this doesn't automatically mean mental illness was the cause. She quite simply wanted Naomi dead. She told police from that Monday she'd had thoughts of killing Naomi and also had suicidal thoughts and considered both killings while driving to work. We are reliant upon her for an explanation. She may not have given a full and truthful account to the police in interview. It is unclear whether she believed Naomi would be better off dead or if her motive was more selfish." Over a 2-week trial, the jury of 8 men and 4 women heard the whole terrible story as I've brought here thus far, hearing testimony from medical staff, police officers, and Simon Hill, who cut a tragic figure as he spoke eloquently in the witness box, describing his and Joanne's turbulent relationship, the problems in the marriage caused by alcohol, and how she'd struggled with Naomi's diagnosis of cerebral palsy, saying how Joanne would veer between having a good, overpowering relationship with Naomi, when she would buy her a lot of toys and generally dote on her, and being not so good with her. He added, describing his wife's fondness for a drink, "Towards the end, it was very difficult. Joe, more often than not, was drunk in the kitchen when I got home. The house would be in darkness, and Naomi would be asleep on the settee in the lounge." Both the childminders who had cared for Naomi through her life gave evidence to the court also concerning Hill's drinking. Karen Gallimore, one of the last people to see Naomi alive, told Chester Crown Court that Naomi was a confident, bright, beautiful little girl, and that she blamed herself to a degree for allowing Naomi to go home with Hill when she'd picked her up on the day she'd killed her. Weeping in the witness box, Karen told the court Hill would occasionally arrive at her home in Kelserton Road, from where she ran Little Monsters with an assistant, saying, "She looked like she'd been drinking, and was a little unsteady, perhaps, on her feet." Asked by Mr. Chambers to define the condition Hill was in when she sometimes would pick Naomi up, Karen replied, "On occasion, she smelt of alcohol. On other occasions, she stared at you as if she was not listening to you. Sometimes she was quite chatty, and other times she'd be quite abrupt and go. I was concerned and discussed it with my husband." On the day of the murder, Karen said Hill smelt of alcohol but didn't appear drunk, telling the court, "She seemed fine in herself, a little flustered, but then Joe always seemed flustered." She also told the court that she was aware of Hill's history of depression, and she knew Hill was not happy for other people to know her daughter had cerebral palsy, frequently covering up Naomi's calipers with trousers. But she added, "I never got the impression that Joanne wanted her dead." Naomi's childminder when she'd lived in Chester from 2003 to 2006, Alison Hockridge, supported Karen's account, saying she too held concerns about Hill's drinking and agreed that Hill struggled to accept Naomi's disability, saying, "She was diagnosed in January 2006. Joanne did tell me, and we sat down and discussed it, but she made it quite clear she wasn't happy for others to know. I took Naomi with some other children to a local nursery, and Joanne made it quite clear she wasn't happy with anyone knowing about Naomi's cerebral palsy. It wasn't obvious, but people would ask what's wrong with her leg." Alison told the court that sometimes she refused to hand the youngster back to Hill because of her drinking, saying, "There were occasions when I wouldn't let Joanne take Naomi because she smelt of alcohol. This was after she'd been diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Sometimes she was argumentative, suffice to say she'd had a drink, and I didn't think it responsible for her to take Naomi. It was my decision. She was slurring her words, and on one occasion fell down two steps down my drive into my garden. I would phone Simon, and he would either come to get her, or I would drive her up to the house and meet him there." She added, "Naomi was always very happy around her mum. She never appeared scared or worried to be with Joanne. I always felt Joe and Simon doted on Naomi and never imagined anyone could do any harm to her. I didn't believe either of them could have hurt her." Hurt her. One of them killed her. Without doubt, the most chilling evidence heard before the court were transcripts of Hill's police interviews following arrest, in which she described in an eerily steady voice to interviewing officer Detective Constable Andrew Roberts how she had killed Naomi. The following extract makes for disturbing listening. "I picked up Naomi from the childminder and took her home. I put the TV on and she was watching it. I ran the bath and had a glass of wine. Then I put her in the bath. She was a bit whingy, but not a lot. I was being forceful with her. I said, 'Come on, you're having a bath,' and told her to sit down. Then I pushed her down. I held her down by the head against the bottom of the bath, on the back area of her neck and head. It just happened so quickly. She's lying on her front with her face to the side and turned on her right side after a while. I think she'd gone. She'd stopped moving and she didn't come up." Asked by DC Roberts how long she had held Naomi underwater, Hill replied she was not sure, adding, about 5 or 10 minutes. He asked her what she'd been thinking about at the time, and she said she didn't know. DC Roberts then said, "Did you understand that if you held her head underwater, then she would die?" Hill replied, "Yes." When asked by DC Roberts if when she took Naomi upstairs and filled the bath higher than normal, was it her intention to kill Naomi? She replied, "Yes, I knew what I was going to do. I needed to get out of the house because my husband said he was coming back at 7:30 p.m. The detective asked her, "Why did you want to get out of the house before your husband returned?" Hill replied, "Because of what I'd done." She then said that in the weeks before Naomi's death, she'd been taking medication for depression, had suffered sleepless nights, and also entertained suicidal thoughts. DC Roberts asked her, "You were perhaps going to do something to Naomi and then to yourself?" Hill replied, "Yes, but I just wanted to make sure that if I did do something to myself, I would do it properly. But it's just, you know, where do you get 200 paracetamol from in one night?" In a later interview, Hill said she'd suggested to her husband that Naomi should be put up for foster care or adoption because "I just thought she would have a better life." DC Roberts also questioned Hill about the amount of alcohol she had consumed that day, to which Hill replied she'd drunk 2 glasses of wine at lunchtime, a third after she'd finished work, and a fourth when she'd arrived home with her daughter, admitting it was a problem and the cause of conflict between her and her husband. Asked about where she went on the 8-hour drive between leaving the house and arriving at the hospital's A&E department at 3:35 a.m, Hill told police she couldn't remember everywhere she'd been, saying, "I was confused. Well, obviously my state of mind wasn't all there." She did tell them that she went to the spa on Station Road in Queensferry, where she bought a second bottle of wine that evening, and also parked up outside the Grosvenor Garden Centre on the outskirts of Chester City Centre, where she drank more wine. Between this, Hill was caught on CCTV at the Shell petrol station in New Brighton near Mould at 11:35 p.m, where she was remembered by staff there for filling up with £10 of petrol, for which she had no money and had laughed and joked about paying for it with a Matalan card. ANPR cameras near to Dobbs Hill, just off the A55, had then caught her heading towards Chester, and she was caught again on camera near the Grosvenor Bridge in Chester shortly before midnight, before heading to the Garden Centre on the B5445 Wrexham Road. Where else Hill went before she arrived at the Countess 3.5 hours later is not known, but she's unlikely to have remained parked by the Garden Centre for the whole time, as she would surely have been spotted. In an example of how erratically, yet calmly, her account was delivered, Hill then described Naomi as a happy, headstrong and cheeky child with lots of friends at school, and told DC Roberts that the night before the murder, she had slept in the same bed as Naomi, as they'd both woken up in the night, and that she loved her daughter. "People might not think I did, but I did," she added. It's a disturbing and sad account indeed, that, isn't it? And I add that in, as I do, as full as I have, never to sensationalise, but to try and convey the mindset of Joanne Hill that evening. This interview, all responses delivered calmly, took place mere hours after she drowned her own daughter. Horror beyond belief. So, while it was unquestioned that at the time of her trial, Joanne Hill was undoubtedly suffering a severe mental illness, the question for the jury was whether Hill was mentally ill on the day she'd killed Naomi, the defence case resting on proving Hill was suffering an abnormality of mind. But deciding whether somebody is mentally ill at a particular time is, of course, a complex task. Dr. Aideen O'Halloran, Clinical Director of The Orchard, a secure unit for female patients from Broadmoor Hospital, and psychiatrist who had examined Hill for the defence that August, described Hill's illness as some kind of atypical affective disorder, saying Hill was in a trance-like state for much of their time together. She explained, Hill doesn't fit neatly and tidily into any typical variation. She appears to become ill quite quickly, and she appears to respond relatively quickly to the medication. She then relapses. The nature of this illness is that it is relapsing. She is known to be someone who is vulnerable to stress, and combined with not taking medication, the risks increase. Statements by witnesses about Hill's behaviour in the weeks, days and hours leading up to Naomi's death indicated she was suffering a relapse of her condition, said Dr. O'Halloran, continuing. Descriptions of her being very matter-of-fact about Naomi's death show she was cutting off her emotions. It was disconnected from logical, rational thinking and normal emotion. She was suffering an abnormality of mind. Stephen Riordan KC, defending, said to her, To establish diminished responsibility, we have to prove the defendant was suffering an abnormality of mind. Was Joanne Hill suffering an abnormality of the mind at the time of Naomi's killing? Dr. O'Halloran replied, In my opinion, she was. She had odd thoughts, and those odd thoughts were never fully explained. At times, people thought those thoughts may have been psychotic, which is when a patient loses contact with reality. In my view, she was suffering from depression, of which she had a history, and she was also using a mechanism of disassociation to disassociate her feelings. The combination, in my view, is an abnormality of the mind. Under cross-examination by Mr. Chambers, the doctor was also asked whether she thought Mrs. Hill would have killed Naomi if she was not disabled. Dr. O'Halloran said, That is a very difficult question. She may have done, she may have not. There was a link to her depression. But Dr. Paul Chesterman, a consultant forensic psychiatrist who gave evidence for the prosecution, told the jury that having looked at the evidence from other witnesses and his own assessment, he didn't believe Hill's actions suggested a mental disorder at the time of the killing, saying it would have been obvious to anyone if Hill had a mild or severe depressive illness at the time, and the signs would have started to show over a 2-week period. She would have been unable to share a joke with work colleagues, or to even generally cheer up. Plus, he pointed out that Hill had enjoyed a night out, and had even had sex with a workmate on the Thursday before Naomi was killed, behaviour that Dr. Chesterman said was incompatible with clinical depression. Mr. Chambers asked him, You were aware the defence is saying at the time of the offence she was suffering an abnormality of the mind, which was a typical affective disorder. In your opinion, was the defendant suffering from a typical affective disorder? He replied, No. Mr. Chambers then asked, Doctor, in your opinion, on Monday, November 26th of last year, was the defendant suffering from an abnormality of mind? Dr. Chesterman replied, She was not suffering from any psychiatric disorder that could have amounted to abnormality of the mind. He also stressed to the jury that unusual behaviour does not necessarily indicate the presence of a mental disorder, telling Mr. Riordan, It is unusual for a woman to kill a child, clearly that's certain. Does it follow, though, that there must be a mental disorder of some kind? In my experience, the answer is unequivocally no. However, he agreed she had in the past suffered from depression and that evidence suggested she was mentally ill at the moment and that it would not be appropriate to transfer her back to prison. In his closing speech, Mr. Chambers told the court, Simon Hill told you the defendant had never accepted Naomi. The defendant didn't like people to know Naomi had cerebral palsy. It must have only been a few days before the defendant killed Naomi that she was saying to her husband she wanted to have Naomi adopted or at least fostered by the childminder. By saying she wanted to have Naomi adopted, she was rejecting her. Simon told you that in the weeks preceding the killing, the defendant was drinking heavily and it caused a deterioration in the marriage. We know on the Thursday before the killing, Hill was drinking and sleeping with another man. We say that the evidence of what she did on the day and night of Naomi's killing, evidence of what she said and did, shows that she was rational. We say she was not suffering from a mental illness at the time when the defense concedes she killed Naomi and intended to do so. She clearly knew what she was doing. This was a deliberate and conscious act. She killed Naomi because she was disabled, seen as the solution to her own problems. She sought to justify it by saying Naomi was better off dead. This was clearly misguided and fundamentally flawed, but that does not mean she was mentally ill. Sometimes people do extremely bad things such as this. Mr. Riordan, for the defence, retorted by asking the jury to ask themselves, what is it that could change a slim, attractive, bubbly young woman into the pitiful individual you see before you? This illness, which from time to time Joanne Hill has suffered, has dominated her life, whether she liked it or not. Whatever affected her has influenced her behaviour. It is not something you can shake aside, pull yourself together and get on with. It is a disease that needs treatment, and when it doesn't get treatment, it gets worse. Responding to the prosecution case that Hill had killed Naomi to solve her own problems, Mr. Riordan said, how did it solve her problems? What kind of tortured, abnormal mind comes up with that sort of thing? Who, with a normal mind, who has just resolved her problems, then dresses her dead child up and then drives around, stopping to drink wine? What normal mind does that? Do we see the workings of a normal mind in the 7 or 8 hour period following the killing of Naomi, or do we see, everywhere we turn, evidence of an abnormal mind in this case? Mr. Riordan reminded the jury that during the 8 hour drive, Hill had visited a shop and a petrol station. He added, she's got a dead child on the back seat, an extraordinary abnormal thing. If you don't get to mental illness in time, it is undoubtedly a disaster, and in this case, it was followed by tragedy. Joanne Hill killed her daughter. She will have to live with that for the rest of her days, but at the time, she had an abnormality of mind which significantly impaired her ability to consider what she was doing. On Tuesday, 23rd of September 2008, Mr. Justice Edwards told the jury of 8 men and 4 women they could only reach a verdict of either murder or manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. After being sent out at 12:50 p.m., they returned just after 2:30 p.m. to reveal that they had unanimously found 32-year-old Hill guilty of murdering Naomi. Upon hearing this verdict, as she had throughout the hearing, Hill sat impassively in the dock, surrounded by 2 nurses and a guard. Sentencing Hill to the mandatory term of life imprisonment, Mr. Justice Edwards described the case as a tragedy for all concerned, and told Hill its aggravating features were the vulnerability of Naomi and the breach of trust between mother and daughter, saying, you killed your own daughter because you could not cope, in my judgment, with a child's disability such as it was. You had other pressures upon you, a disintegrating marriage, and you decided to kill your own daughter by drowning her. Having said that, although there's an aggravating feature, equally you have had a sad history of mental problems, and I take that into account as it would be inhuman not to. Hill was then told she would have to serve a minimum tariff of 15 years before being considered for any release. Because of the murder conviction, Hill would not return to the Teith Llewellyn Hospital at Llanfairpwllgwyngyll, but would instead be taken straight to prison, though the judge said he hoped she would be transferred back to a hospital very soon, adding, "This has been a very sad case. Sad for you, for your family, for your husband and his family, and tragic for the daughter you killed. There can be no excuse for what you did, and I'm afraid you must now pay the penalty. This has been a case where there are no winners, only losers. I offer my sincere condolences to the relatives of Naomi, who have throughout this case behaved with complete dignity." As she was led away, Hill looked visibly stunned, while her mother wept quietly in the public gallery. Simon Hill, meanwhile, squeezed the hands of relatives sitting next to him as he tearfully watched his wife being taken away. Following the verdict, the officer who led the inquiry, Detective Inspector Simon Price, said, "Naomi was described in court as a beautiful little girl, and indeed, she had the whole of her life before her. The fact that her life was ended so prematurely is in itself a matter of sadness. However, for this to have taken place at the hands of her mother makes it all the more difficult to comprehend. I know I speak for every member of the investigation team when I say that, although none of us knew Naomi Hill, none of us will ever forget her." With such a case, of course you wouldn't, would you? There's a school picture of Naomi up on the show's Instagram page, one of many that was published in the wake of Hill's trial, and this picture has haunted me somewhat whilst researching and writing this episode, because, bless her, she looks adorable. I'm sure you'll agree when you see it, and I have to agree with D.I. Price, Naomi is truly someone you'd never forget. Simon Hill also made the following statement after his wife, who by the time of the trial he was in the process of divorcing, had been convicted. "Firstly, I'd like to thank the people who helped me and my family during this horrendous time. I don't want to embarrass people by naming names. They know who they are, and I thank them deeply." It has been said in court that Naomi suffered with cerebral palsy. That is not true. Naomi didn't suffer at all. She lived life to the full and was an inspiration to us all. Naomi took everything in her stride and enjoyed doing everything that four-year-olds do, if only slightly slower. She loved being outside. She loved the garden and growing flowers. Naomi loved the beach and being by the sea, where she'd build sandcastles and paddle all day long. Naomi loved riding her bike around the park and would wave and chatter to everyone that passed. Naomi loved dressing up, especially in pink. Naomi loved everything pink. She also loved spending time with her grandma and grandpa, who she could wrap around her finger with ease. Naomi loved going to school. She would talk incessantly about all of the friends she'd made and the fun they'd had, not just in her class, but the whole school. Naomi was a chatterbox, a great storyteller. She had a wonderful sense of humour and a wicked taste for mischief. She could make me laugh all day long. Her cheeky grin and beaming smile could light up a room in an instant. There is not a minute that goes by without me wishing she was still here. She was my constant companion. She was my best friend. She was my little princess. The fact that Naomi has been taken away from us at such a young age and in such a terrible way is something we will never come to terms with. Joanne is a non-swimmer with a fear of water. To be held underwater is her greatest fear. What she did to my Princess Naomi was evil. What do you even say to that, eh? Bloody hell. Poor, poor man. Now, he'd mentioned this in court whilst he was giving evidence, but following Hill's imprisonment, Simon Hill told the Sunday Mail newspaper that since her arrest for murder, he had only spoken to Joanne once in a 45-minute telephone call while she was on remand in the Teith Llewellyn psychiatric unit awaiting trial. Exactly 6 months to the day that she'd killed Naomi, almost to the hour even, and gave details of that conversation to the newspaper, he explained. I was petrified and ran to the windows thinking she might have been outside. I didn't think she would have been allowed to phone me. I asked where she was, what she did, and why she was phoning me. We hadn't spoken since Naomi's death, and suddenly she was on the line sounding quite normal. It shook me. It was almost the exact time of day Naomi had died, which I found very disturbing. She began by casually telling me she missed me and wanted to come home. She told me something about having an affair with a guy from work that she apologised for and asked if I was okay. My first reaction was to shout at her. I was very angry with her. I couldn't help myself. I let rip with all my fury, asking her how she could possibly have killed our daughter. She replied in a monotone. Her lawyers had told her to say she couldn't cope with Naomi because I was unsupportive of her in looking after Naomi. I eventually calmed down and asked her questions. I asked her why she'd killed Naomi, and she repeated she couldn't cope. She didn't know why she'd killed Naomi, but that she should have killed herself. Every time I asked her why she had killed her, she said that she didn't know. She said she was being told to say she was ill, even though she felt okay. That was by the lawyers and people at the hospital, she said. She said she thought she was better. I asked if she realised the enormity of what she'd done, and if she even understood what she'd done, and she said yes. She said again that she didn't know why she'd done it. She couldn't explain, but said she didn't think she'd done anything wrong because she was ill. Then, as if she was apologising for spilling a drink, she said, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear any remorse in her voice whatsoever. I told her never to call me again, and that was the last time I spoke to her. For Simon, the months since the previous November had been spent not only grieving for his little princess, but struggling to come to terms with how the woman with whom he'd spent a decade of his life could commit such an appalling act. He must have gone through all kinds of emotions, certainly one of these being anger at the suggestion by some that the sentence Joanne Hill received was unjust, that she'd killed Naomi merely because she was ill, which Simon disagreed with, saying, I accept that for Joanne coolly to run a bath, put bubble bath in, and then hold Naomi under the water, something must have happened in her mind. Nobody thinking normally, especially not a mother, could behave like that. But I believe she made a conscious choice to kill Naomi, a choice to do something evil. It came out in court that she'd been planning to kill Naomi all day at work while outwardly behaving normally. I looked after her during her worst periods of depression. When she was really poorly, she couldn't function. She couldn't even dress herself or take herself to the toilet. If she'd been that unwell on that day, she would have been incapable of doing what she did. Simon further added that the sympathy some expressed for Joanne because they believed she had to struggle to look after a disabled child was misplaced, for he reiterated that despite Naomi's condition, she was an able child and taking care of her was not a struggle, saying, Naomi didn't seem disabled. Apart from needing a little help to walk, she was totally normal. She was bright, cheeky, full of energy and enthusiasm, and she'd try to run around and play just like any other child her age. If Joanne had tried to kill me or herself, it would have been different, but to take away our beautiful little girl's life when it had barely begun is unforgivable. I feel strongly that justice has been done. He also told how he was considering selling the family home that he now lived in alone, saying, his eyes filling with tears, "I miss Naomi every second of every day. She was the light of my life. Her room is untouched, with all her favourite toys exactly where she left them. I can't bear to go in there because it upsets me too much. There are too many memories here. It was Naomi's house. I will never forgive Joanne for taking her away from me." Simon admitted that he was tormented by a sense that he could have done something to prevent Naomi's death, and felt strongly that his family was badly let down by health professionals who knew Joanne was severely depressed, but didn't help enough, never warning him that his wife's depression might put Naomi at risk, saying, "I thought it was my duty to try and look after Joanne. Now, I wish I'd been able to put a stop to her behaviour. Perhaps I was naive, but I hope the doctors were right when they said if she took her medication, she'd be okay." But because of the complex psychological problems Hill had, perhaps still has, she may not have been able or even willing to open up about the extent of her difficulties. Perhaps why Hill didn't seek the help she needed. Unsurprisingly, the charity Scope, which helps people with cerebral palsy, confirmed following her trial that it had no record of Hill ever contacting it for the support that sadly was readily available. Dr. Eideen O'Halloran, who had examined Hill for 3 hours the previous August ahead of her trial and who had given evidence as a defence witness, as we heard, said, "Joanne Hill was quite a closed person who appeared to struggle to access her emotions and consequently may not have made professionals aware of her needs. This case highlights the weaknesses of relying on categorical diagnostic systems, which require individuals to fit neatly into category or risk, not having the disorder recognised by the court. It highlights the mismatch between the clinical context and judicial context. It is difficult to get across complex psychiatric, psychological problems in an adversarial arena, where complex shades of grey do not fit neatly with the black or white answers required." The case prompted the Flintshire Safeguarding Children's Board to carry out a full serious case review of the care and treatment that Joanne Hill had received prior to Naomi's death, and in September of the following year, the findings of the review, which had examined the contact between the Hill family and mental health, education, health and antenatal services, were made public. Chairperson of the board, Susan Lewis, said in the findings that there were no signs that Naomi was at risk and that her death was not predictable. It also concluded that there were too many imponderables to consider whether her death was preventable or not. The authors also found that Naomi's disability, described as very mild, and Hill's response to it had no bearing on the incident, for Hill was said to have a good relationship to her daughter when she was in good mental health. In addition, the review said that there was no evidence to suggest Hill's increased alcohol intake at the time of the killing was outside her normal behaviour patterns. It continued, "There are no serious failings identified within this review. The review looked in great detail at the history surrounding the circumstances leading up to the death of Naomi, the knowledge of professionals directly involved with the child, and also the mental health services experienced by her mother. In many ways, this family received good service provision. As authors, we were impressed with the dedication and care shown by all the staff who we interviewed. Case records were full, all meetings were conducted to schedule, and promises made were kept. Nevertheless, no matter how good our services are, we are never complacent. Accordingly, the authors have recommended, and we have accepted, a range of recommendations which we have already started to pursue in advance of this publication to improve operational policies." There were some 14 recommendations for improvements in procedures made, including Carers of patients receiving mental health services should be more fully involved with those working with their relatives. More information should be sought from people making referrals to mental health teams. Crisis teams dealing with mental health emergencies should have a clearer point of contact for patients and their carers. Paediatric services should give greater consideration to mental health issues. But as always with these reports, and we do hear them from time to time on the show, don't we? You kind of get the feeling that sadly, nothing will change, don't you? A dreadfully sad tale all around this one. Joanne Hill's crime is truly a monstrous one, isn't it? And yet, I do have a certain degree of sympathy there, much as I did for Magdalena Lasica in the episode Control from last series, and Carly Ann Harris, who featured in a Patreon episode I did some years ago called An Offering to the Angels, each of whom took the life of their own child. I in no way excuse the actions of Joanne Hill, but as Simon was quoted, for someone to do something so abhorrent to a child, their own child no less, something has to have happened. You must be acting as some sort of automaton, mustn't you? And you would think, surely cannot be in control of your own actions. No one of a sound mind convinces themselves, I'm going to drown my 4-year-old tonight, and then does it, do they? So my sympathy does extend somewhat there, because mental illness that leads to something such as that, I wouldn't wish on anybody. And as we know, mental illness can affect anyone at any time. And sadly, tales such as these are more commonplace than you would imagine. It's a bit of a complex one to give thoughts about this tale, because from what we've heard, heavy drinking aside, Joanne Hill was, perhaps still is, a woman who had clearly struggled greatly with her mental health for a considerable time. And surely the misplaced sense of shame that she felt at having a child who, in her eyes, was less than perfect due to a cerebral palsy, is a manifestation of this mental illness, this depression. As is the thought of giving her up for adoption because of this. Because every child, no matter what, should be nothing but perfect to their parents. That unconditional love for them from the moment they're born should supersede anything else about them. And you shouldn't feel shame for your child having cerebral palsy to hide her calipers as much as you can, or lose patience with her for unavoidable incontinence. For as Simon said, the only difference being Naomi could do anything other children could, it may just have taken her that little longer physically. So, you have an individual with documented mental health problems and a history of depression, but one who made the conscious decision to do what she did of sound mind, as one psychiatrist testified, who then admitted it fully at the first opportunity to police in interview, and what was decided in a court of law. Yet, it is difficult to believe, isn't it? I understand why a custodial sentence was issued. Precedent sets that, but it was in effect a hospital order, for it's likely Hill would have been transferred to a psychiatric facility at the earliest possible opportunity following the verdict. It's very difficult to find out these things, of course, but it is possible that today, Joanne Hill has been released, her minimum term now long since served, and having received the help she so clearly needed. It's a very real possibility. But if so, what does she come out to? Long since divorced from Simon, friends and ex-colleagues perhaps long having moved on from her, her actions of that November evening 17 years ago now always remain in that predominant thought with everyone who knew her. It's an effective brand new life needed there, a move away and perhaps even a name change, yet all the while having to live with the guilt of what you've done for the remainder of your life. A continual punishment, that. Meanwhile, Naomi's extended family must, and Simon Hill undoubtedly does, still live each day with his own memories. Losing a child must be devastating enough in any circumstances, but at the hands of the person supposed to love and protect them more than anyone else, how would you even begin to try and come to terms with that? Coincidentally, Simon Hill and I have a mutual friend who told me just how hard it was for him to come to terms with for many years after. As the years have passed, I truly hope Simon has managed to, though, and has found happiness once again, whilst of course not forgetting his pink princess Naomi. The independent report into Naomi's death you've heard me refer to in the episode contained a footnote that I found particularly striking, one I feel is quite fitting to add in here to bring the account to a close. It said, Naomi wrote in her last school report that she wanted to grow up to be a princess. Her head teacher wrote that she was already a princess. We hope this is how she will be remembered. I hope that it is too, and I hope that's how you imagine her. This episode is dedicated to Naomi. I would love, as always, hearing your thoughts and feedback concerning the tale I've brought in A Misplaced Sense of Shame, which you can do so in the episode thread that's now up in the show's Facebook discussion group, or by using any of the show's social media links. If you want to, get in touch wherever you want. I won't shout, and I really don't mind at all. You know that. With that, it is on to the next tale out of the bag, which will be coming to you very soon. I thank you very kindly for joining me and the Mog here today. Not that he does bugger all, like, he's just the eye candy. And all that remains for me to say is that I have been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast, wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. Take care all, stay safe, and goodbye for now.